All right.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world, and happy Friday, everybody. Today is June 19th, 2026. Now, markets are closed today for Juneteenth, and typically I wouldn't be doing a show on a morning where a bank holiday when stock markets are closed, but we've had a couple of stories developing that I think warrant us getting together this morning to have this conversation. In particular, the big one this morning, the Iran deal, it's already falling apart. It's been a day, a freaking day. Now, I mean, I was talking yesterday about how this deal was so terrible, and there's no shortage of commentary about how bad for the U.S. this deal is. So we're not going to rehash all that. But the point I made yesterday was how this deal was so bad, it's setting up for the next conflict. It looks like it's falling apart so quickly that we can't even call it the next conflict because they never stopped shooting in the first place with the last one. So what's going on this morning? Fighting between Israel and Hezbollah and Lebanon has been unrelenting. It didn't stop at all. And that is not surprising because Israel never agreed to this deal. Iran made us put in the comment that this includes Lebanon. Okay, well, if it's going to include Lebanon, then you better put two more freaking lines on that memorandum of understanding, one where Israel signs and one where Hezbollah signs. And neither of them are there. Neither of them signed. And so this stupid freaking proxy war is continuing now because the people who agreed to the deal are not the belligerents involved in the fighting. So, of course, that's still going on. And you know, look, I don't care who shot first. There's all this, he shot at this. There's retaliation for that. They've been killing each other for decades. At some point, it's got to stop. It's not going to be today, though. That's for sure. Now, because the fighting in Lebanon has not slowed or stopped at all, Iran yesterday pulled out of the 60-day negotiations that were supposed to start because of the MOU. So, I mean, we didn't even get 12 hours into this thing before already the bickering started. Because the Iranian delegation pulled out of the 60 days to flatten the curve negotiations, this morning, J.D. Vance decided he's not going to go to Switzerland for those negotiations because he would have been the only one there. So, of course, Vance isn't going. Now, as the negotiations are falling apart because Israel and Hezbollah are still fighting in Lebanon, we've got Iran appears to have closed the Strait of Hormuz again. And again, there was like a really good 12 hours there where a couple of Saudi boats made it through, like 6 million barrels of oil got out. We were talking about that yesterday, and it's gone. Iran, the Persian Gulf Strait Authority, or the PGSA, which is Iran's little, you know, extortion racket, put out a note to ship owners yesterday that basically imposed mandatory Iranian insurance in order to cross the Strait of Hormuz. And that is no different than the street gang that comes into your window and says you need to pay us for protection. And it's like, protection from whom? Protection from us. If you don't pay us, we'll throw a brick through your window and burn your business down. That is what Iran is doing to ship owners in the Strait of Hormuz. They're calling it insurance now. They tried calling it environmental fees, then transit fees, or the toll booth. It's all the same thing. And by the way, the terms of the deal said no tolls, or at least no tolls for 60 days, as if to suggest after 60 days, tolls might be going back on there. Again, what an awful deal this was. But that is the Iranians already going back on the terms that they agreed to in the memorandum. So, hey, it was a really nice 12 hours, wasn't it? While this is going on, while this insurance silly thing is going on, the IRGC is now broadcasting on Channel 16. That's the emergency channel to ships, basically saying the strait is closed. Avoid the area for your safety because of the Zionist terrorist regime and all that other silly propaganda bullshit that they're always spouting off. No ships have been shot at that I'm aware of, but somebody's about to get shot at. Now, even as all this is going on, this is kind of interesting. You've got Trump and Khamenei both, you know, U.S. president, the Iranian Ayatollah, they're both setting up their underlings to take the blame for this thing falling apart. And it's funny because they dress different and they claim to pray differently. I don't think either one really prays all that much. I think they're just power hungry scumbags. But hey, that's just me. They're both setting up their underlings to be basically like, this deal is your deal. And if it falls apart, it's your fault, not mine. I just find that honest. It's the one thing they can both agree on, Trump and Khamenei, that no matter what happens, they're not going to take the heat for this war continuing. No, it's their immediate direct reports that it's their fault. So, hey, they've got something in common. And this is all, you know, just another example of how you cannot unkick a hornet's nest. If you kick a hornet's nest and you get stung, you might be like, oh, I regret that. Time out. Let's unkick it. No, it doesn't work. And when we started this war, we kicked a hornet's nest, right? There's no debating that. And then we fought the war half-assed because we were more worried about the price of oil than we were about achieving victory on the battlefield. And historically, when politicians are allowed to dictate the pace of a war because of other interests, financial, business, otherwise, the wars don't end well. History's full of examples like that. So, you know, we fought a half-assed campaign. Not that the soldiers did a half-assed job. The soldiers did an excellent job. We won all the battles we were willing to fight, but we were not willing to hit them where it would really hurt because it would have also hurt us, Karg Island. And so now we have this situation going on, and supposedly we've got 60 days of negotiations that are not happening, even though it's day 59 now, or day one of 60. There's 59 days left. Who knows what's going to come out of this? But one thing is for sure, oil still doesn't care. Now, how about that? With all that happening, the price of oil, at least as of when I hit record, was actually down 30 cents. I don't really get that. So I guess the oil market was expecting this, is not surprised by this. Maybe the oil market knows something. I don't know. Maybe this was all like agreed to silly theater that they all said, okay, on the first day, we're going to do this and do this, but nobody shoot, nobody do any of that. It's just a show for the hardliners at home, and then we'll all meet up a week into the 60 days. Maybe that's what's going on here. Or maybe this deal was bullshit to begin with, and it's just a matter of time before they start shooting again. All right, also going on, there's some more interesting news going on overseas. In the UK this morning, there was the UK had their elections yesterday, and their bond yields, the UK 10-year gilt, is higher by a decent clip. It was about 8 basis points the last I looked. So the UK bond market is unhappy. What happened? Andy Burnham was the mayor of Manchester, and he won this election by a huge, huge margin. I guess he's headed to Parliament now. And my grasp of UK politics is limited. You may be able to tell. But he is now headed to Parliament, where he is all but guaranteed to launch a campaign to unseat Keir Starmer, the wildly unpopular prime minister in the UK, which would, if it goes this route, and it looks like it is going that route, that would make Andy Burnham the 6th prime minister in 7 years in the UK. Holy shit. Can you imagine having 6 presidents in 7 years here in the United States? You think that might be a little chaotic? You think maybe that'd be a silly exercise? That is the state of things in the UK. And the reason why these politicians keep popping up and dropping off and popping up and dropping off, it's because the bond market is freaking out in the UK. I know that's what torpedoed Liz Truss and who came in behind her. And that appears to be what's torpedoing Keir Starmer. And look, the UK has some hard questions. They have exploding budgets in that country because they let in millions of people who are just absolutely smothering their welfare state. They've got anemic economic growth at best. So the economy is not growing in order to sustain that. They're also trying to scale up their military spending for all the good it's doing. The UK Navy is a joke and a shadow of its former glory. They couldn't even put a frigate in the water to do something about the Strait of Hormuz. They claim they didn't want to, but the real truth was they couldn't because their fleet is broken down, rusted tubs. So they've got some hard questions ahead. Are they going to raise taxes or are they going to cut spending? They're not willing to do either. And so their bond market is freaking out. Now along comes this other guy, Andy Burnham, who has historically made a lot of comments like, oh, the government shouldn't answer to the bond market, which is a colossal blunder to talk that way. Everybody answers to the bond market, whether they want to admit it or not. And so he's kind of walked back that position a little bit. He's moving centrist as he's trying to gain power now. But the bond market is freaking out because a politician who wants to spend more money taking over in the UK means more demand for pounds, more interest, higher bond yields. So that's not good. That's going on this morning also. We've got SpaceX is raising $20 billion in the bond market already. All right. It's been, what, 4 days since the IPO? And SpaceX is now looking to borrow $20 billion, almost certainly to build out more data centers and data centers in space. And Elon Musk is comparing himself to Union Pacific Railroad in interviews now as an explanation for why he wants to raise that money. And well, you might want to be careful with your allegories, my dude, because for anybody who knows anything about history, Union Pacific Railroad, they filed for bankruptcy in 1893 after overinvestment, speculation, and self-dealing led to a nationwide depression. Okay, you want to compare yourself to Union Pacific? I'm all right with that. I'm not sure you are. Do you even know what you're saying here? But $20 billion in bonds after raising $75 or $80 billion in their IPO, all to sacrifice and burn at the altar of artificial intelligence. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on with Kevin Warsh and the higher interest rates, in particular, what that means for private equity, who has not had a very good couple of years. Higher interest rates, not good for those guys. And last but not least, we got more details about the collapse of Market Financial Solutions. That's that UK mortgage lender who borrowed billions of dollars from American banks and then used it to supposedly give out mortgages in Bangladesh during COVID. But it turns out people thought they were signing up for COVID stimulus. They were really signing up for mortgages. They never made any of the payments. And the CEO made off with all this money. And yeah, private credit does lots of due diligence. And don't worry, they have rigorous underwriting standards that protect their investors, even though somehow that happened. Guys, we got a lot to talk about, even though it's a closed day today. So why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world. And hey, don't forget that like button, that subscribe button, so you can come back on Monday and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this every business day. And again, markets are closed, so we're not going to go through the indexes this morning. We're going to fast forward right to the DXY. And the dollar is unchanged here at 100.82, settling in at this level just below 101. The dollar strengthened quite a bit this week, all in the aftermath of Kevin Warsh's debut at the FOMC. And that's important because oil dropped significantly this week. And you would think that weaker oil would have weakened the dollar because all that oil trades in dollars. And less price of oil means less need for dollars to buy that oil. But the dollar is actually stronger this week because of what Kevin Warsh said at the FOMC. So that is a very interesting development. That is one of the prevailing winds in the market that shifted this week. Also, while we're on the subject of the dollar, keep one eye on the yen. That strengthening of the dollar has weakened the Japanese yen further. We're now at 161.25 yen to the dollar. This is USD JPY. And just a reminder for you guys who are new to this, you see this chart moving upward. That is the yen weakening versus the dollar. And the level of 160 is significant, as we see this red candle right here. Because typically at 160 is when the Japanese central bank or the Japanese finance ministry intervenes in order to rig markets and strengthen their currency. And it's important because they did that back in 2024. They did that a little bit too much, and they triggered the yen carry trade panic of August of 2024. That caused some pretty rough days in U.S. stocks. And well, we're now back at that level where historically the Japanese regulators have acted. So keep an eye out for yen intervention as early as next week. Looking over at the bond market, which is open today. We have the 10-year is moving. That's the only thing that's moving right now. So we'll talk about the 10-year. 4.473, that's higher by 1 basis point. Not a lot of movement going on here in U.S. bonds. But I do want to talk about U.K. bonds. That's the reason to look here, scrolling up a little bit. Look at the UK 10-year gilt higher by 6.5 basis points. Looks like that's the big move. It was 8 points higher earlier in the day. That big move higher in yields. Remember, yields moving higher, that is bond prices moving lower. People are selling UK debt this morning in response to that election. Let's talk about that. Rebel lawmakers' election win clears path to oust UK Starmer. Andy Burnham's entry to parliament sets him up to challenge the prime minister for leadership. There's Andy Burnham there. British politics is set for a fresh bout of chaos after Labour politician Andy Burnham won a special district election, allowing him to enter parliament and launch a leadership challenge against the deeply unpopular prime minister Keir Starmer. Burnham, the 56-year-old mayor of Manchester, was elected by a comfortable margin in voting Thursday to represent the district of Makersfield in northern England, defeating a candidate from the anti-immigration party Reform UK. By entering parliament, Burnham can now attempt to unseat Starmer as Labour leader and prime minister, raising the prospect that the UK could get its sixth prime minister in 7 years, a period of unprecedented turmoil in one of the world's oldest and most stable democracies. I don't know how stable the democracy is. I read a lot about people getting arrested for freaking Twitter posts in the UK right now. I'm pretty sure when you're arresting people for things they write on Twitter, it's not an indicator of stability. But that being said, the UK bond market is throwing a bit of a fit this morning. Not a huge one, right? 6 to 8 basis points. That's not the worst we've seen from the UK gilt market. But gilts were already pretty high here. We're above levels where the gilt market freaked out back in 2022, leading to Liz Truss's government collapsing. So it's important to keep an eye on that one. There are some hard decisions facing the UK on what their priorities are and how they're going to manage their finances. And so far, 5 of these prime ministers we've had in the last 6 years have all been unwilling to address those. Maybe this guy's going to be different. New boss, totally different as the old boss, maybe. Looking over at the commodities market, commodities are changing hands this morning in our trading. So spot gold is lower again, 4,163 for spot gold. That's lower by 45 bucks or 1.07%. Are we looking at a 3 handle in gold soon? It really looks like it. The charts are pretty ugly for precious metals. Spot silver is down again as well, 64.98 for my favorite of the shinies, lower by 73 cents or 1.1%. But for the long term, I still like the shiny. We've got copper is lower by 0.38%. Platinum is down 2.7%. Palladium is down about that same amount. And crude oil, look at this. WTI crude for July, lower by a dollar now. 1.29%, 75.61 for oil. Oh, put a pin in that. We'll be back to oil. That's just amazing. This deal's falling apart and oil is down. Looking over at Bitcoin this morning, it is lower again. $62,700 is priced on Coinbase, lower by about another 200 bucks. This is now 4 days of declines in a row for Bitcoin after it had a pretty good week last week, getting back down around the lows that we've seen for this cycle. Again, I think Bitcoin is moving sharply lower before the end of this winter. But the big story is not Bitcoin. The big story is Stretch once again. And I think this could be the catalyst for the next big leg lower in Bitcoin here. Stretch went as low yesterday as $82.53. These are those strategy preferred equity shares that are supposed to be pegged at 100. And Michael Saylor told investors they were going to be pegged if they bought this. And I think investors had the wrong idea of what he meant by that, because they're getting pegged all right, just not the peg they were expecting. $88.59 for Stretch. I mentioned this, a lot of these Saylor apologists and Bitcoin hodler bros and the maxis were out in force on Twitter yesterday running to Michael Saylor's defense. Why? I don't know. The guy is a complete a-hole. But look, I get it. I think Stretch is facing lawsuits because they deceptively marketed this. The CEO is out giving interviews comparing this to a high-yield savings account or a money market account. He's out talking about how it's going to be low volatility because they'll just raise the dividends in order to prevent the price from falling. Well, the price is now down, 12, 13%. It was down at 1.18%. Why haven't you raised the dividend yet? Oh, that's right. If you raise the dividend, you need to raise more cash. The way you raise cash is by selling Bitcoin. What triggered this collapse in the first place? Selling Bitcoin. Oh, I see. That's how infinite money glitches become doom loops. And all these Saylor apologists are like, oh, read the prospectus, buddy. They never said it, all this other stuff. Yeah. Fine print is not a shield that lawyers are unable to penetrate, all right? Oh, this just in, retail investors never read the effing fine print, and that has never stopped one of these crooks from getting sued in the past, and it won't stop this time. When the CEO is out in public giving interviews saying the opposite of what the prospectus says, that makes a lawsuit more likely, not less. And so I think strategy's got big problems on the horizon here. They need to do something about this. I don't know what. But look, guys, at the end of the day, this was never a company. This was never a stock, all right? This is a unsecured debt instrument with an unsustainable yield from a borrower who is a degenerate gambler who does not have to pay you back ever. This was never a good idea. And there's stories in the press about working class people who spent, you know, basically all their retirement buying this stuff because Saylor promised them this safe yield. And they've already lost more than they're going to yield in their first year of dividends. So I really think it's just a matter of time before the lawsuits start flying. All right, but on to the main story this morning. Israel Hezbollah clashes put Iran deal under early pressure. 4 Israeli soldiers and at least 8 people in Lebanon were killed in the fighting, authorities said. Just a reminder, Hezbollah and Israel never agreed to the MOU, so it's not surprising that they're not adhering to it. Fighting intensified between Israel and Hezbollah militants in Lebanon, posing the latest test to Israel's increasingly fraught relationship with the U.S. and President Trump as he seeks an end to the war with Iran. Talks between the U.S. and Iran that were set to be held on Friday in Switzerland were called off amid the escalation, threatening to derail progress after an agreement was reached earlier this week to stop the fighting and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. The White House said Thursday that Vice President J.D. Vance, who is leading the U.S. negotiating team, would not be traveling to Switzerland to meet Iranian counterparts as planned. The Swiss Foreign Ministry confirmed talks were postponed and said it stands ready to facilitate should they resume. The reason Vance isn't going is because yesterday the Iranian delegation said they weren't going. Fighting between Israel and Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah has become a major sticking point in negotiations and driven a wedge between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Trump, his most important ally. Their interests have diverged as Netanyahu seeks to keep up pressure on Iran and Hezbollah while Trump looks for a way out of the war. Tehran insists that any peace deal with Washington must include Lebanon, while Israel says it will keep up the fight there. All right, so as the fighting continues in Lebanon, it's now spilling over into the Strait. We got this one from Lloyd's List this morning. Iran imposes mandatory insurance on ships transiting Strait of Hormuz with fees likely to follow. Insurance from what? Insurance from them not blowing up the boats, which means a protection racket, which means if you don't pay us, we'll kill you. And it's only been a day since we signed the deal that said they weren't going to do that. Iran has asserted its control over the Strait of Hormuz, insisting that vessels comply with new terms and conditions to transit, including mandatory Iranian insurance for all vessels. Iran has introduced mandatory insurance for all vessels transiting the Strait of Hormuz, requiring ship owners to obtain coverage approved and initially provided free by Tehran's newly created Persian Gulf Strait Authority, which is the little IRGC gaggle of gangsters that's going to blow you up if you don't pay them. The move detailed in the PGSC terms and conditions document seen by Lloyd's List effectively sidesteps a new U.S.-Iran memorandum of understanding that guarantees safe passage of commercial vessels with no charge for 60 days. Aha! There's that 60 days. So they put the infrastructure in place that forces you to sign the form. We'll give it to you for free for 60 days in the spirit of the MOU, but after that, if you don't pay us, we'll kill you. Iran's insurance requirement carries no fee during that period, but Tehran has confirmed that charges may be imposed once the 60-day window closes. This insurance is provided free of charge to the vessel owner. Oh, they're so generous, aren't they? With all expenses covered by the Islamic Republic of Iran. The PGSA reserves the right to introduce insurance fees in the future. Owners will then be required to purchase and renew coverage accordingly. Okay, so we're doing that. Now, as this is going on, I've seen several reports of this. Now, this one, I want you to take this one with a little bit of a grain of salt. I've tried to independently verify this, and I can't. But I can tell you this is highly believable in the context of what I see going on with the insurance thing and things happening elsewhere. Several people are reporting this quote here. And the quote is, IRGC on Maritime Radio Channel 16, that's the emergency channel, given that the withdrawal of Israel from Lebanon, the complete lifting of the naval blockade, and the departure of American terrorist forces from the Persian Gulf and the region are core conditions for an agreement between Iran and the United States, the Strait of Hormuz will remain closed until these two conditions are met. All vessels are hereby instructed to avoid approaching the Strait of Hormuz for their own safety and security. Any vessel that disregards this order will be targeted. That is what the IRGC is allegedly broadcasting on Channel 16 right now in the Strait of Hormuz. Again, I have no way to verify this, but I can tell you based on all the other news coming out this morning, this tracks with what's going on. So this deal is falling apart in real time. And as this deal is falling apart, both leaders are setting up their underlings to take the blame. We got this one in U.S. News and World Report. Iran's Khamenei says he approved the MOU with the U.S. despite reservations after assurances on Iran's rights. Oh, he reluctantly approved. Okay. Iran's Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei said on Thursday that he had authorized a memorandum of understanding signed by the Iranian and U.S. presidents, despite holding a different view after receiving assurances from President Masoud Pezeshkian and other senior officials that Iran's rights and interests on the resistance front would be safeguarded In a written message to the Iranian nation, Khamenei and Pezeshkian, in his capacity as head of the Supreme National Security Council, had accepted responsibility for ensuring the agreement protected Iran's interests and pledged not to yield if Washington made what he described as excessive demands. So basically what Khamenei is saying here is it's Pezeshkian's fault if this doesn't go well. And, well, that's interesting because what has President Trump been saying? He's been joking slash not joking that it's Vance's fault if you don't like the deal. Throwing J.D. Vance under the bus, forcing J.D. Vance to defend the deal. So you've got both the Ayatollah and the president putting their underlings in the crosshairs of any blowback because this deal might suck for their sides. So, hey, it's not like there's no common ground between these two. They both agree that the right thing to do is to screw over the guys who report to you if something goes against your way. And again, oil, look at it. Oil just doesn't care. This is a little different than what we saw in the futures pricing a second ago, higher by 25 cents, but still oil barely moving on this. Guys, the strait is closed. Where is this relentless optimism coming from about these negotiations? Somebody out there knows something I don't. 75.81. For oil with the strait closed. All right. Also going on this morning, SpaceX's epic fundraising campaign for AI has only just begun. Guys, they're already leaning on the bond market. When Elon Musk went into sales pitch mode ahead of the SpaceX IPO, the comparison he marshaled to justify valuing the company in the trillions of dollars and tapping investors for tens of billions raised a few eyebrows. We're kind of like the Union Pacific, he said in an interview in an investor presentation ahead of the initial public offering, citing one of his frequent touchstones, a historic infrastructure project in the 1800s intended to connect Western states by rail for the first time. People thought they were crazy when they built it, he said, but now California is the biggest state in the country. The pitch from one of the world's most successive and divisive entrepreneurs was typical Musk, the world's richest person and first SpaceX, with its plans for orbital data centers and a colony on Mars to a name evoking an essential part of America's growth into a superpower, a prize easily justifying the investment that lifted the company's market value above $2.5 trillion in a handful of trading days. The IPO wasn't the end of the fundraising campaign, though. It was the start. SpaceX is already turning to the bond market and is preparing to seek at least $20 billion in its first deal, Bloomberg News reported. Capital expenditure could surpass $700 billion a year by 2031 in one estimate. Is that too much to ask when the goal is, as Musk put it, making Star Trek real? Oh, my God. Guys, what are we talking? Make Star Trek real? Come on. $700 billion? They just IPO'd at a $200 billion valuation or a $2 trillion valuation. Where are they going to get $700 billion to burn in CapEx? What are they had, what, $8 billion in revenue last year? Come on. Come on, guys. All right? I get it. The new and exciting thing in science fiction. Come on. Ask the backers of Union Pacific. Construction of the railroad flamed out and stopped in Utah, not California. That project was propped up by the government support as it minted generational wealth for insiders before ultimately failing. Richard White, an American history professor emeritus at Stanford University, called the original Union Pacific a mess of self-dealing and corruption. To use that as your model of what your corporation is going to be plays on the immense ignorance of history of this country, of financial markets, and most Americans, he said in an interview. And holy shit, is that a powerful comment, guys. Elon Musk is out comparing SpaceX to Union Pacific, who filed for bankruptcy in 1893 after largely contributing to a depression two depressions, the panic of, was it 1879 and 1893? There was two big major unwinds in the railroad bubble. He's out there comparing, and people are like, oh my God, it's the next Union Pacific, not realizing that means the company's destined to collapse. And again, this guy's saying it. To use that as your model of what your corporation is going to be plays on the immense ignorance of history of this country, of financial markets, and most Americans. And well, this whole bubble's built on ignorance, isn't it? And speaking of another bubble built on ignorance, shout out to Illiquid Insights on X, who posted this one last night about private equity. And he says, don't expect private equity exits to pick up. Inflation means rates stay high and weak deal activity continues. And higher interest rates are largely considered to be responsible for the reason why the, we'll say, free market values of private equity assets tend to differ wildly from the advertised net asset value that these funds put out about their holdings. And what this chart is showing is the total amount of private equity assets that have been held for 7 years or longer. And you'll notice in the 20 teens, when interest rates were super low, private equity was very, very easily IPOing these companies to sell them and take their profits, or, you know, selling them to another company, or otherwise exiting, returning cash to their investors. But since COVID, since inflation hit and interest rates went higher, these private equity firms have been forced to hold on to their assets longer and longer. Now you've got over $1.1 trillion of private equity assets have been held for 7 years or longer. In other words, these firms are trapped in these deals. And the reason they're trapped is because they can sell them. They can, but they would have to take a value that is much less than what they're telling their investors these assets are worth. And so they're doing secondaries, they're doing continuation vehicles, CV squared, which is a continuation vehicle of a continuation vehicle. They're doing net asset value financing, all these cockamamie schemes and new acronyms for things that is all about the avoidance of price discovery. And if you want to have an exercise or a pretty funny event, just walk into the office at any private equity firm in America and just shout, "The floor is price discovery," and watch everybody jump up on their desks all at once because they're terrified of finding out what this stuff is really worth. Now Kevin Warsh is in charge at the Fed, and he came out like a hawk yesterday, right? Kurt Hawk, he's the new man in charge at the Fed, which means rates are going higher, if anything. I know there's some people are out there are basically justifiably being skeptical of what Warsh said, claiming he's going to change the metrics in order to lower interest rates, even though inflation is moving up. I can see how you would get there, but you have to take them at face value early on. They haven't changed the metrics yet. They appointed a task force. The market is 100% convinced that rates are going higher, not lower here. And so you have to assume that is the case here, which means these private equity assets are going to be held even longer. Yikes. At some point, they're going to have to face price discovery, but it ain't today. And last but not least, you know, speaking of private asset valuations and alternative assets and the rigorous underwriting standards that these people have, collapse lender MFS is said to have never registered 300 million pounds of mortgages. And this is one of the ways that the CEO was looting the company. A 300 million pound portfolio of mortgages linked to collapse lender Market Financial Solutions looks to never have been registered with public property records, according to court filings, threatening to complicate lenders' efforts to establish their claims over the underlying assets. Twin Win LTD, a company within the wider network of MFS companies, held the mortgage portfolio, but didn't appear to register the loans, according to the documents filed on Thursday as part of a petition to liquidate the company. Registration is generally required to protect the lender's interests in a property and establish priority over other claims. MFS was at the center of a sprawling group of companies that borrowed from backers, including Barclays and Apollo Global Management's Atlas SP Partners. The London-based firm, which was supposed to use the money to finance short-term real estate loans, collapsed amid allegations of wrongdoing and fraud. The CEO has since fled to Dubai. The filings highlight the hurdles facing liquidators unwinding MFS as they seek to trace and locate assets and maximize recoveries for creditors. One of the allegations of fraud involving MFS was that the firm obscured the true ownership of security position of assets. Earlier this year, officials overseeing the insolvency alleged TwinWin was a vehicle used to siphon off monies and was directed by MFS CEO Paresh Raja. So what are they actually saying here? Again, this company is now bankrupt and default, and they're all fighting over who's going to get what, picking at the bones. Somebody's going to lose hundreds of millions, probably billions of dollars in this. So apparently this TwinWin was the owner of hundreds of millions of dollars of these loans, but those loans were never registered. They were never officially filed with government authorities. And therefore, that makes it really hard for the lenders, the people who loaned Market Financial Solutions the money, to go into court and say, those assets belong to us. Because those assets, as far as the registry with the government is concerned, don't even exist. So what was going on? It looks like what happened was TwinWin created these mortgages, never finished the paperwork. And then what I suspect was going on, as those people were making payments, the CEO was just putting the money in his pocket. And those mortgages were issued with money that was borrowed from these American private credit firms, which means that money is freaking gone. They're not going to get it back. And if they do get it back, it's going to be pennies on the dollar. And how was this going on? How did the people underwriting this deal not catch this stuff? How did they not realize that a lot of these mortgages were fake, that they were tied to loans in freaking Bangladesh? And the people who took out those loans didn't even speak English, couldn't even read the document they were signing. They were being told it was COVID stimulus. They were actually signing them up for mortgages. And yet none of the firms who lent these people billions of dollars checked any of that freaking paperwork. Isn't that the kind of thing that you would verify? And these are the people who are telling us in CNBC and at all these conferences, don't worry, the worst is behind us in private credit. Oh yeah, don't worry, it's all fine. It's overblown. These are isolated events. A lot of people seem awfully isolated these days. Well, guys, I just want to say thank you very much for having your coffee with the Melon Heads this morning. Hey, today is Friday. That means it's our weekly get-together for a Q&A over Zoom with my magnanimous Melon Head supporters on Patreon, YouTube, and Buy Me a Coffee at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Links down below should you feel so inclined. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the algorithm on your way out. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. I love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.